Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is October 9th, 2014, and I am Carolyn Yeager. When my co-host calls in, Ray Goodwin will be bringing you episode 31 today, and it is a good one. There's lots of foreign policy talk from Hitler and also domestic policy. So much is explained by him that people don't understand and get all excited about unnecessarily, in my opinion. So it's going to be fun to discuss this. Hi, Ray.
Hey there. Am I coming through all right?
You're coming through just fine. Yeah, you can go ahead and introduce yourself
okay.
if you want.
Hey, this is Ray Goodwin back to Hitler's Table Talk for this evening. And looking forward to tonight's thought-provoking material.
Isn't it great material?
Oh, yeah. My goodness. A lot of history. And ideology, too. Very good.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, I just was really fascinated with it, and I've got lots of little notes and things to talk about. So
good.
I didn't have us getting any further than what I got, but we might get further than that. But I just didn't put it all. Even so, I've got a lot of items on my menu here on the program post. So, yeah, it's really meaty and explains. In fact, I learned things. It explains a lot about things that people are, I would say, question or disapprove of Hitler about. And it explains a lot of it, I think, in a way that made me feel more ready to defend Adolf Hitler than ever. You know, he was really. Things would have been so great if he had been able to do what he wanted to do, and it would have been good for everybody, for all white people, all European people. So, well, okay, I don't want to overpromise, so I know you're going to start reading the first one, but I've got, we're going to be, it's about the Hanseatic League, and
yes.
I just had a little bit of information about that, and maybe I'll just go ahead and read that right off. There's also,
sure.
I got a timeline. What is the date for this first day? I don't know.
Okay, the book is 29th of March, 1942 at dinner.
Oh, it's the 29th. Okay. I have the timeline for the 28th, which was the RAF sends a raid against Lübeck, destroying over 30% of the city, and 80% of the medieval center, and Hitler is outraged. Now, Hitler starts in tonight talking about Lübeck and the Hanseatic League. And then I realized when I looked at the timeline that's why. You know, so there again, it all ties in. This just happened on the 28th. The first really big RAF raid. That it was started up a firestorm and so on and destroyed so much. So, in fact, I've got here that during World War II, Lübeck was the first German city to be attacked in substantial numbers by the Royal Air Force. The attack on 28th March 1942 created a firestorm that caused severe damage to the historic center. The bombing of Lübeck in World War II destroyed three of the main churches and greater parts of the built-up area. Well, they always downplay it, you know, like, oh, three churches, oh, that's not so bad.
Right.
The actual is 80% of the medieval center. And this was one of the most beautiful, oldest medieval cities in Germany, up on the Baltic Sea. It's just, it was, no, you know, that's the kind of thing that just makes you furious, and just there's no sense in it. And it says here that Hitler was just outraged by it. And another thing on the 28th was that British commandos launched the raid on St. Nazaire, HMS Campbelltown, filled with explosives on a time delay fuse. They rammed the dock gates, and commandos destroyed other parts of the naval service area. Made the port completely. It just completely destroyed the port, which is what is St. Nazaire. I didn't look that up. Completely destroyed the port, and which couldn't resume service until 1947. But by doing so, they lost two-thirds of their raiding forces. So two-thirds of those British commandos were killed. But I guess this was pretty important. Is this the French? Is this in, I don't know where this is. And I was so caught up with Lübeck that I didn't think about checking into that more. Well, anyway, so now on this evening, Hitler is talking about this. And let's see what he has to say.
All right. 29th of March, 1942, at dinner. Commercial honesty in the Middle Ages, 500 years of honesty, legal juggling, reforms in the magistrature, three good lawyers. The Führer had alluded to the respect enjoyed by merchants and princes during the Middle Ages. In the discredit now attached to them, he saw the work of the Jews.
Yeah, well, Ray, this is our note-taker, right? This is Henry Pickard.
Yes, yes, this is italicized remark. I should have noted that. And,
yeah.
It's just a kind of an intro into when Hitler starts talking.
Well, I think that's good. I like the way he does it.
Sure. Okay, now this is quoting the Führer. The Hanseatic League should not be regarded solely as an instrument of political power. It also personified, on the level of relations between individuals, a conception of justice. For example, it never agreed to carry a consignment unless it was provided with a sure guarantee of the weight and quality of the goods. Equipped with the Hanse's seal, the goods thereby enjoyed a high reputation, both in the interior of the country and abroad. A case is cited of some cloth merchants who had employed the Hanseatic agency in Lübeck to send a bale of linen to Bergen. Now, this merchandise did not correspond to the Hanse's specifications, with the result that, by way of a sanction, the guilty city was excluded for a period of 10 years from the traffic of the League. What is important to notice is that the decision was not taken as the result of a complaint by the addressee, but simply as the result of a checkup held at the outset. It was observed that the merchandise did not correspond to the specifications. A few threads of flax were absent in the weaving of the linen. It was not one of the Hanse's least merits to have stabilized the notion of commercial probity, as it is still honored in some houses in Bremen and Hamburg. It was thanks to very severe sanctions and even to barbarous punishments that gradually this conception of probity in trade was established. When the Hanse refused to refused its seal to a merchant, for the latter, in view of the League's prestige and the extent of its relations, this meant the first fruits of ruin. The example of the Hanse inspired all commercial and industrial activity of the Middle Ages. That's how the price of bread could be kept the same for 400 years, that of barley, and consequently that of beer, for more than 500 years. And this, in spite of all the changes of money. The notion of probity was not implanted solely in commercial relations. It was the basis of the small crafts. The guilds and the corporations always took care that this tradition should be maintained. A baker, for example, who cheated on the quality of the flour intended for the manufacture of rolls, was ducked several times in a basin filled with water, and in such a way that he escaped only by a hair from drowning. As soon as the Jews were allowed to stick their noses out of the ghetto, the sense of honor and loyalty in trade began to melt away. In fact, Judaism, this form of mental deprivation that must at all costs be abolished, has made the fixing of prices depend on the laws of supply and demand, factors, that is to say, which have nothing to do with the intrinsic value of an article. By creating the system of caveat emptor, the Jew has established a juridical basis for his rogueries. And thus it is that during the last two centuries, with rare exceptions, our commerce has been dragged down to such a level that it has become absolutely necessary to apply a remedy. One first condition is necessary: to do away with the Jews.
Uh-huh.
There was a Yeah. Well, okay. I'll tell you what, let's stop right there for a second.
Yeah, let's do. You go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say the phrase caveat emptor, I'm sure our listeners probably know, that means let the buyer beware. So you can see what the Hanseatic League had stood for was honesty in business dealings, and that whoever ordered got what they ordered, and the quality they ordered, and the quantity that they ordered. And they had developed quite a reputation, and you could see that the various merchants realized that if they were going to get the Hanseatic League's stamp of approval, they had to deal fairly and honestly with everybody. And then Hitler says, here come the Jews putting their nose into it, seeing that there's going to be a lot of money to be made. And by the time they started exercising their financial power on the merchants, it switched around from, okay, Mr. Customer, Mr. Buyer, whatever you're ordering and buying will be delivered exactly as you specified, to caveat emptor, which is Latin for let the buyer beware, meaning if you get took, tough stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Hitler
said, it's up to you to somehow make sure or look for the most honest one or something.
Yes.
It's not up to us to make sure that everybody is behaving the way they should, which is what they did. They enforced these rules of theirs. As you said, this one, if somebody was guilty of even a little bit, they took them out and gave them a public dunking.
Yes. Yeah.
And other type punishments. Plus, their reputation was injured. You know, and that was very important to these people.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go ahead and start reading again, but if you
I'm going to say a little more.
Yeah.
This was considered a confederation of merchant guilds for commercial and defensive purposes. And so I guess they also kind of defended the coast along there because they were the ones who were, the waterways, they were the ones who were using it. And it was all along the coast of Northern Europe, the Baltic Sea and the North Sea. And in inland to the late Middle Ages and early modern period, that is from the 13th century to the 17th centuries. It lasted a long time, like things at that time did. Everything wasn't changing every other minute. And it originated in Lübeck in 1159 by the powerful Henry the Lion, Duke of Saxony and Bavaria. Hitler later, and he has before, says that Henry the Lion is too highly thought of, and that there are things he did that he didn't think were good. But anyway,
right.
It was Henry the Lion who rebuilt Lübeck after he captured it from Adolf II, the Count of Schauenburg and Holstein. And I thought this was interesting. The legacy of the Hansa is remembered today in several names. For example, the German airline Lufthansa, and the company FC Hansa Rostock, the Hansa University of Applied Sciences in the Netherlands, the Hansa Brewery in Bergen, the Hansa Bank in the Baltic States, now known as Swedbank or Swedbank, and the Hansa Sail in Rostock. And there was a major German shipping company from 1881, but it went bankrupt in 1980. It was named DDG Hansa. So all that comes from there, and it was a great traditional thing that really shows the kind of thing that Germans will do when they're creating something like that. You know, I mean, they're the most, to me, I think they're the most honest people, the most upright people in Europe, really. I do.
Agreed.
Or the Germanics, I'll say.
Right.
But you really have to have those Germans, those actual Germans in there to get it done right. And this was something, and Hitler then is telling us that a couple hundred years ago, the Jews managed to get in, and then it went downhill. Was not the same. Slowly.
Exactly, and I think something of extreme significance too, Carolyn, in that little section I just read was when he mentions that the commercial and industrial activity of the Middle Ages the price of bread could be kept the same for 400 years.
I know.
That of barley and of beer for more than 500 years. This in spite of all the changes of money. And see, this is the stability that they had before Jewish speculation entered into it. And the supply and demand and, oh, well, we got to charge you more because of this or things like this. And so that's the very significant thing to me, the stability of those prices for all, that far, and comparing that to today and the gouging and deception that goes on. It's, hey, you know, he hit the nail on the head with this.
Well, right. And, you know, it's this period of time was good all around Europe. And it included the Elizabethan age in England, and I read about this at one time, and it's always stuck with me so strongly how stable life was with these guilds, and the merchant guilds and the craft guilds were very well established, and the people stuck like guild members. They their daughters married guild, other, you know, people in that guild or in other guilds or something, that what you might call the middle class or something, you know.
And they
had the upper classes, and they kept to themselves. But even though the middle class didn't have what the upper class did, they did very well for themselves, and they were they were happy, and they didn't marry far outside of their kind of people that they were, and it made for a very strong and stable society. So I've always remembered that, and that's part of why I think the way I do about how we should, what kind of marriage partners we should look for. We shouldn't look so far away, you know.
You know, we're on the same page on that, because I read a lot of that stuff too and studied that, and for a young male, to become an apprentice in one of these guilds and things was considered, oh my goodness, you know, that's the fellow I'd like my daughter to marry there. And it was just a badge of honor and success to be a part of that organization. And
right, and they took a lot of pride in their in
oh,
what
exactly.
they did.
Yeah.
And
sure.
That well, and you know, I love the idea of no inflation. I really don't like, I hate when things get into such large numbers and money, even though it's the same thing, but why should something that used to cost a nickel now cost, $3? And it would say, well, you get more money, so it's all right. I just don't like the idea of having those kind of numbers and those, all that money, you know, when you don't need to do it.
Exactly.
You don't need to have this huge amount of numbers, and only the Jews benefit from that. In some way, they benefit.
That's right.
From.
That's exactly correct.
So, I remember. I can remember so much, as I'm sure you can, Ray. How much you could do with a nickel when I was
exactly.
a kid. Nickels were cool. You know, you could buy a whole candy bar, regular size candy bar for nickel. Get on the bus and go anywhere. lots of things. I could go on and on about that, but I'll stop.
yeah,
but, you
true.
Know, it's just too bad that, and now the money we have is just like plain money. That bothers me,
oh,
too.
Oh, that's exactly right.
It has
that's
no
that's
weight.
True.
It's just like, I don't know what it's made of.
Yeah, nickel, nickel and copper rather than silver.
Yeah.
And, so the value is gone.
Right. Well,
okay,
and that's our world. That's what we can thank the Jews for. And I like the way Hitler said, our first condition to fix all this is to do away with the Jews. And of course, he doesn't mean to exterminate them. Although sometimes
right.
you wonder if there's any other way to do away with them. But that wasn't what his idea was. But he wanted
right.
to get them out of
yep.
the society, or at least, and certainly out of running things. That was the first idea. To get them out from having influence and so on. Okay.
Okay. Now the Fuhrer goes on. There was a time when I suffered from fistulas, and this affliction seemed to me more serious than it actually was. Having thought of the possibility of cancer, I one day settled down at my table to write on official paper a holograph will. As you know, this task demands quite special effort on my part, since for years I've had the habit of writing directly on the machine or dictating what I have to say. My will hadn't had time to grow old when I learnt of a decision by the Court of Appeal that declared an old woman's will null and void simply because mention of the place was printed on the paper instead of being written by her hand. I took my head in both hands and wondered what the law was coming to if the will of the Chancellor of the Reich in person did not satisfy the legal formalities. I came to the conclusion that such juggleries are simply a mockery and scarcely the sort of thing that gets justice respected. So I sent for Gertner, the Minister of Justice, and requested him to have this idiocy put right. Well, it took nothing less than a decree to achieve this result. I was equally struck by another...
I'll just say, people, this is not very nice, but we need to learn all about Hitler. So he's talking about this. He had fistulas. Well, a fistula is a permanent... We know he had digestive troubles. A fistula is a permanent abnormal passageway between two organs in the body, or between an organ and the exterior of the body, and individuals with certain gastrointestinal diseases, like Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease, are at increased risk of developing fistulas. Well, anyway, it worried him. He thought maybe he had cancer. He was always thinking about that. So he was making a will, but it luckily that wasn't it. It was just something he had to live with.
Right. And right there, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did want to make a comment on what we just read. You know, when he says this lady's will was declared null and void because something on it was printed rather than written in her own hand, and he says such juggleries are simply a mockery, so he called the Minister of Justice and requested him to have this idiocy put right. And he said, well, it took nothing less than a decree to achieve this result. So this is interesting to me, because it shows you right there that Hitler couldn't just declare this or declare that and say, hey, you got to change this and make it right now. And it didn't just automatically happen. There was resistance to things that he wanted to put right.
He had to follow the law. And they say, even you.
Yes.
Mein Führer have to do this. We can't make an exception for you.
That's right.
So, he didn't make himself a king, so he went along with it. Yeah. You know, another thing about this inflammatory bowel disease, a lot of people have it, and in fact, Alex Linder has been suffering from that for quite a while. That's his problem. So you just never know who's going to get it or who's going to have that.
Correct.
All right.
Okay. I was equally struck by another stupidity. It often happens that people leave me legacies. In principle, I refuse these, only permitting the NSV, the party's welfare organization, to benefit by them. Now, so that such a declaration may be valid, my signature must be authenticated by a notary. So it seems, according to our worthy jurist, that the signature of the German Chancellor, accompanied by the seal of the Reich, is worth less than that of a notary. A merely reasonable being could not conceive of such a thing. That's only a small example, but I suggest in principle that it's impossible for a normal intelligence to understand any part of the edifices built up by the jurists. And I can explain this mental distortion only by the influence of the Jews. In a nutshell, I regard the whole of our present jurisprudence as a systematization of the method that consists in saddling other people with one's own obligations. I shall therefore do everything in my power to make the study of law utterly contemptible, if it is to be guided by such notions. I understand, of course, that university studies should turn out men who are fitted for life and capable of ensuring for the state the preservation of natural law. But the studies to which I'm referring merely cultivate the liking for irresponsibility in those who devote themselves to them. I'll see to it that the administration of justice shall be cleared of all judges who don't constitute a genuine elite. Let their number be reduced to a tenth, if necessary. the comedy of courts with a jury must come to an end. I wish once and for all to prevent a judge from being able to shake off this responsibility by claiming that he's been outvoted by the jurymen or by invoking other excuses of that nature. I desire only judges who have the requisite personality, but in that case, they must be very generously reimbursed. I need men for judges who are deeply convinced that the law ought not to guarantee the interests of the individual against those of the state, that their duty is to see to it, above all, that Germany does not perish.
Hey, you know, Ray, this is pretty controversial. And when I read it, I thought, gee, he's saying that he doesn't like juries and he just wants judges to decide everything. And I thought, oh, I don't know what I think about that, because I think that often a jury will do a better job than the judge. But the trouble is we have all these corrupt judges. You know,
yes.
And so if you have corrupt judges, then a jury is a better deal often for someone to get a fair trial. If you don't have corrupt judges, I think I would agree that that the judges are better equipped to make decisions.
Right.
And in Germany, it seems to me that the judges were, of course, maybe he thought they were too much this way. But the judges in some of these cases that came up, like with the eugenics laws and so on, that they were very fair and very, very considerate and so on. And if you go into a German court, even today, they make sure they treat everybody real well. Maybe that's part of what he didn't like, though, because maybe they're just catering to the individuals. But he's going to say a little more about this, and then it made me feel that I could go along with what he was thinking.
Right, and you know that concluding sentence there, he says, "Hey, all these judges, their duty is to see to it above all that Germany does not perish." In other words, that some goofy ruling that they make winds up hurting so many people.
Right. I mean, it's always the same thing. It's always the nation that comes first. So, but
right.
You're so big on American history and so on. What do you think of this? What would you think of thinking like this about juries? Or maybe here we need juries, but maybe in that country, you know, a National Socialist country, it's a different thing.
Well, what you did there, Carolyn, was hit the nail on the head when you mentioned if your judges are not corrupt, because no matter how good and persevering and honest a jury is, a judge can ruin or he can disallow things in a trial and a jury may not want to convict somebody, but they're told, well, you have to because it's the law. It's the law. But in America, there is a juror's guidebook that tells the jurors, if you feel that common sense it overrides that law, and that law, if applied here, is in the wrong, then you can certainly vote to override it. Well, they get in a courtroom, and they're not allowed to know that, and the judge tells them, you can't go outside the law to make your ruling.
That's right.
That's garbage, you know.
That's right. I tried to say that on a program I think I was doing not too long ago, but you said it much better. I didn't know it was in the law book there. But I knew that it was true that the jury didn't have to follow those directions that the judge gives you if you something different. And so they're not told that. I was on a couple of juries, and I sure thought, I said, oh, boy, this jury stuff is not hard because they tell you what you have to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find this, it's this way. If you find that, it's that way. And I thought, well, it makes it simple. Yeah, well, then they're... they don't want you to think for yourself all that much, really. And probably most jury people can't. So, I mean, I think if you have really good judges, they really understand things, and that would be probably better, but they have to be good judges. All right, let's go on.
Sure, and they have to be certainly nationalists of the first order.
Yeah.
Okay, he says, Gertner has not succeeded in forming judges of this type. He has himself had a lot of difficulty in getting rid of his legal superstitions. threatened by some and despised by others, he has succeeded only slowly in adopting more reasonable attitudes, spurred on by the necessity of bringing justice into harmony with the imperatives of action. If anyone were to think that I chose Gertner as Minister of Justice because once upon a time in his capacity as a judge he must have treated me with particular understanding, that wouldn't at all correspond to the facts. It was I who had to make an effort of objectivity, and a great effort too, to call to the Ministry of Justice the man who had me imprisoned. But when I had to choose amongst the men who were in the running, I couldn't find anyone better. Freisler was nothing but a Bolshevik. As for the other, Schegelberger, his face could not deceive me. It was enough to have seen him once. I've had an ample harvest of experiences with the lawyers. In 1920, when I organized my first big assemblies in Munich, a certain Counselor Wagner put himself at my disposal as a speaker. That was a period when I was in search of starched collars, in the hope that they would help me to reach the intellectual class. So what a blessing, I thought, this man's offer, and what a bait to win over the lawyers. It's true that before giving him a chance to speak before a big gathering, I had the prudence to try him out before 20 or so faithful followers gathered at the Sternecker Beer Hall. What faces they pulled when they heard the worthy soul with trembling hands and waggling head recommending the reconstruction of a state in which, quoting, the clan was based on the family, the stock upon the clan, and the common mother upon the stock. Since then, I've always been distrustful in my dealings with the jurists. In that respect, I know only three exceptions: von der Forten, Poner, and Frick. Von der Forten, quite the contrary of Gertner, was a man of revolutionary tendency. As for Poner, I still remember his statement during our trial for high treason. Here he's quoting Poner. Above all, I'm a German, and after that, I'm an official. As an official, I've never been a whore. You can take that as admitted. If you think that my activity against the usurpers constitutes a case of high treason, then let me tell you that as a German, I have for 6 years considered it a duty to wage the struggle against the usurpers and thus to commit, if you really cling to this expression, the crime of high treason. Frick, too, conducted himself admirably at that time. As adjutant to the chief of police, he was able to supply us with all kinds of information which enabled the party rapidly to expand its activity. He never missed an opportunity to help us and protect us. I can even add that without him, I'd never have gotten out of prison. But as it is, there exists, unfortunately, a particular type of National Socialist who at a certain moment did great things for the party, but who is never capable of doing still better. When our activities spread beyond the framework of what he has been able to grasp and of what corresponds to his own ideas, he takes fright for lack of being able to take into account the logic of the facts and that certain acts inescapably demand certain consequences.
The tough stuff that has to take place every once in a while. And I can see people, when he says take fright, it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be involved in this. You know?
Very good point. Yeah, that's correct. Dietrich Eckert always judged the world of jurists with the greatest clear-sightedness, the more so as he had himself studied law for several terms. According to his own evidence, he decided to break off these studies so as not to become a perfect imbecile. Dietrich Eckert, by the way, is the man who had the brilliant idea of nailing the present juridical doctrines to the pillory and publishing the result in a form easily accessible to the German people. For myself, I supposed it was enough to say these things in an abbreviated form. It's only with time that I've come to realize my mistake. Thus today I can declare without circumlocution that every jurist must be regarded as a man deficient by nature, or else deformed by usage. When I go over the names of the lawyers I've known in my life, and especially the advocates, I cannot help recognizing by contrast how morally wholesome honorable and rooted in the best traditions were the men with whom Dietrich Eckart and I began our struggle in Bavaria.
Okay, wow.
That's some pretty good stuff there. And it was interesting this phrase he uses here. Dietrich Eckart, by the way, is the man who had the brilliant idea of nailing the present juridical doctrines to the pillory and publishing the results, you know, and that to me symbolically goes back to Martin Luther nailing his 24 mm-hmm. or 25 theses to the church door, whatever, so that the big boys mm-hmm. would have to pay attention. But anyway, that's some pretty good stuff. Dietrich Eckart,
he really hated the lawyers and the law. Exactly. I think he brought Hitler's attention to that. And he says that he actually took those doctrines and nailed them up somewhere and published them in a form that the German people could understand. And yes. That he felt so strongly about it. And Hitler didn't think he needed that much at the time, but he sees now that it does.
And then
he really says,
I've come to realize my mistake.
Yeah.
And that's what he said. And I think it was because, you know, deep down, when you think about an act such as that, it takes courage to do that. And more importantly, it tells the power that be, you know, that they look and they see something nailed up on the wall for everybody to see. Then they know that someone out there has the courage to stand up to them. And it may be timid at first, but it starts them to worrying and to thinking about and to being a little bit afraid. And I think that's what Hitler is alluding to when he says, I realize that I made my mistake by just talking about it in abbreviated form. But anyway, that's what it meant to me.
Well, yeah, and that it takes, just making it very important, and that's what Eckart thought it was important enough to do that, and then Hitler has come around to seeing that it is so important, and he's going to be talking more about this, judges and so on, a little further on.
Yes.
But it's very, very interesting, too.
Right.
Okay.
Now we move
this
on to
this is a real long section.
Yes, it is. We'll be breaking it up. 31st of March, 1942, at dinner, and the headlines highlighting this section are: attempted assassination of Papen at Ankara, confidence in the Turks, distrust of the Bulgarians, German Eastern policy, Charlemagne, slayer of Saxons, and Hitler, slayer of Austrians, the work of Charlemagne, from Chancellor to Führer. The first consul should not have allowed himself to become an emperor. Frederick the Great, a greater man than Napoleon. The best man should be head of state. Examples of the Vatican and the Venetian Republic. The future German constitution. Need of separation of powers. All of that is encompassed in this lengthy section. And the first note, our narrator says, the conversation turned on the attempted assassination of Papen, at the time ambassador in Ankara.
You know, we determined, Ray, we determined previously that after asking around quite a bit that was pronounced Poppin.
Poppin, yeah, that's right. That's what I initially thought it. Yeah, Poppin. Okay, now the Führer starts. This attempted assassination is revealing as it concerns the mentality of the Russian organizers. With other peoples, supposing such an attempt was judged necessary for political reasons, an attempt would be made to save the man who was given the job of carrying it out. The Russians, on the other hand, for all their cleverness, arranged the action in such a way that it should cost the performer his skin. This setting was well designed. The poor wretch had an apparatus that enabled him, once the murder was committed, to produce an artificial fog, thanks to which he could try to escape. But what he had not been told was that as soon as he set the machine working, he would himself detonate the explosive charge that was destined to pulverize him. The only traces of him discovered were one of his shoes and his revolver. The assassin's accomplices were so disgusted by their master's villainy that they decided to reveal all they knew of the plot. Now, that's just the first paragraph right there, Carolyn, but I wanted to stop on that.
Yeah,
it's something that struck home with me on that. he's talking about that attempt on Poppin, the assassination, and he said it's revealing as it concerns the mentality of the Russian organizers. Now, who controlled Russia at that time? Bolsheviks and mostly Jews. And he says the Russians, on the other hand, arranged the action in such a way that it should cost the performer his skin, meaning they wanted no connections back to wherever that could be traced back on an assassination attempt. And, you know, immediately my thoughts go to the patsy Lee Harvey Oswald that was set up and used. But it's the same kind of mentality that pulls off these current assassinations and things like this is the guy that did it is not the real important person right there. And as far as JFK's murder, the guys that pull the trigger are just peripheral. It's the people that organize it, paid for it, and keep it covered up. Of course, that matter. And
you think in this case it's the Jews?
Yes, I do. Because he says the Russian organizers.
I think when he says Russian, he means Russian. And otherwise he'd say the Jewish, or he'd say the Bolshevik or something. Let me just give a little thing. I looked this up because I had never heard of this attempted assassination on Poppin. And at the time he was ambassador in Ankara, Turkey. Isn't that Turkey? Yeah. And he was ambassador
to
Turkey. And this was in... this is, again, current. This was on... It just happened. It was on February 24th, 1942. And let's see... He was ambassador to Turkey from 1939 to 1944, and he survived this Soviet assassination attempt on, of course, it was Soviet, so that's, you know, you can call it, whoever, but Stalin was in charge then. Soviet assassination attempt on 24th February 1942 by agents from the NKVD, so that's what it was, and a bomb exploded prematurely, and it killed the bomber and no one else, although Poppin was slightly injured. So this is Hitler is saying that, the way I read it, he's saying it shows the mentality of the Russians. And again, he may be in that habit of underestimating the Russians. And saying, well, they screwed up here, you know, or they, what he's actually saying, I think, is that they find, as what you just said, they find these agents of theirs expendable. And maybe they just assume, I guess he's saying, like you said, that they had it set up that way, that he would be killed, that the person who's carrying this out would be killed. And, but he says this is their, so the mentality that he's saying is being revealed is that they don't care about their agents or their people or their, you know, like he would care about every German because he cares about Germans, but they don't care about Russians.
Right.
And like you say, if they're the Soviets, they didn't care that much about the Russians until later, and they kind of had to because they couldn't lose all their population and they needed a population there, so they couldn't kill everybody. But I don't know. You're probably more right than I am on that.
Well, I don't know, Carolyn. It's you made a good point, but the thing is, the Cheka or the NKVD were totally run, dominated by Jewish psychopaths anyway. And I don't think such an assassination attempt could have been carried out really just by Russians. I think it had to be approved of and initiated and even thought out by the Jewish element in the Soviet. And that was just my interpretation of it.
Okay.
As allies, I prefer the Turks to the Bulgarians. That's why I'm ready to conclude a trade treaty with Turkey by which we'd supply her with arms and ammunition. In addition, I'd be ready to guarantee the inviolability of the Straits and the integrity of their frontiers if the Turks had any wish for an alliance with us. Our advantage would be as follows. Thanks to the arms we would have delivered, the Turks would be able to defend the Straits, a defense in which we too shall have an interest as holders of territory on the Black Sea. In this way, the authoritarian regime in Turkey would be consolidated. And I think that this consequence on the level of internal politics couldn't be a matter of indifference to the Turkish patriots who wish to support Ataturk's successor. In Bulgaria, on the other hand, everything is uncertain. Thus, I was struck to learn that after the conclusion of the tripartite pact, the president of the Bulgarian Council was scarcely acclaimed by the population of Sofia, despite the major importance of this pact to Bulgaria. And I was not less struck to know that at the same time, the population of Sofia was enthusiastically welcoming a Russian football team. The fact is that Bulgaria is strongly affected by Pan-Slavism, both on the political and on the sentimental level. She's attracted by Russia, even if Sovietized. I recognize that the king of Bulgaria is a very intelligent man, even cunning man, but he doesn't seem to be capable of guaranteeing the stability of his regime. He himself confessed that he couldn't change a single minister or relieve a general of his command without endangering his crown. He has to act very cautiously, he says, beginning with granting sick leaves and then retaining these men's attachment with the help of numerous favors. To sum up, as regards Bulgaria and Turkey, it's certain that conditions have scarcely changed since the First World War. From our point of view, Bulgaria can be regarded as reliable only insofar as we are allies of Turkey. On the political and sentimental level, there's no obstacle to an alliance between Turkey and the Reich. By reason of her attachment to Islam, Turkey has a completely clear-cut religious policy. The same is not true of Bulgaria, which, since it practices the Greek Orthodox religion, finds in it a new reasons to feel friendly towards Russia. And then go ahead.
I found this super interesting. Did you? He's talking about how the Slavs stick together or feel sympathetic, you know, are friendly with one another. And that is affected by their feelings of pan-Slavism. And the Turks don't have that. See, he sees that the Muslim religion as keeping them
unified.
Separate. Well, but yeah. Keeping them separate from any Christians, you
yeah.
know. Or,
oh,
you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
You know, like under Hitler, there would never be any Turks moving into Germany. I mean, that would never have happened. Having an alliance or an agreement with these countries did not mean in any way, shape, or form that you were going to exchange your citizens, you know, and they were going to go here or go there. Really, you know where that all comes from, the European Union anyway, that, oh, we're not going to have any more border controls so that it's easy for us to travel around in Europe, you know, don't have to go through all this hassle of showing papers and changing money and so on. Making it all sound like it's going to be so nice, and people accept that, and then next thing you know, people are just moving around however they want. But he's saying that the Bulgarians, he couldn't rely on the Bulgarians. He felt he could rely on the Turks, he couldn't rely on the Bulgarians. And,
Bulgaria.
Of course, you know, he sees Russia at that time as an enemy, and they're at war, and so these... The Bulgarians, even though they're an ally of Germany, they're too friendly toward Russia, and that their religion for these people, especially for lots of people, the Greek Orthodox religion really does bind people together over and above the Roman Catholic. So the ones who are Roman Catholic don't have that same connection with one another as the ones who are Orthodox. Anyway, I thought that was pretty good. What do you think about that?
I agree.
Yeah. He got along real well with Turkey at that time.
Yes.
The Turks were pretty strong, and they didn't have any reason not to be. They didn't have to kowtow to anybody, I guess, you know. So whoever was running Turkey, if he said this or that, that's the way it was.
Oh, yeah, and you know, I think another admiration he had for Turkey was the ability of their military. They were known as extremely fierce warriors or fighters, And they would hold the line, so to speak, despite the odds. And that was also something that Hitler admired about the Turks.
Oh, now yeah, that's the kind of allies he wanted.
Yeah, yeah. And now this comment here, leading into the Führer's next section, a reflection of Bormann's on Heinrich the First led the Führer to speak of German policy on her eastern frontiers. And the Führer continues, as regards the East, our present policy has no precedence in history. Whereas it is true on several occasions already, combats, sometimes even of a certain size, have taken place on the eastern frontiers of the Reich, it must be agreed that it was then a matter of tribes that came carrying war to our frontiers. And the Reich found itself confronted with the alternatives of accepting combat or disappearing. These old-time struggles cannot therefore be regarded as the expression of a German policy in the East. The historians who attributed the idea of such a policy to Heinrich I were in error. What drove Heinrich I in that direction was merely the fact that only in the East could he hew himself out a kingdom. Throughout the imperial period, it's not possible to discern any sign that the Reich was interested in the East or that it followed any coherent policy concerning the colonization of the eastern territories, for example. The racial policy of the empire was firmly fixed. It aimed only towards the south. The east, with its population totally different in respect of race, scarcely marked by a Germanic contribution to the higher strata, remained foreign to them. The south, on the other hand, and Lombardy in particular, had all the special characteristics necessary to make it part of the Roman Germanic Holy Empire. Thus, it was always one of the essential preoccupations of imperial policy. To what an extent the political ideas of the time were governed by the notions of race is shown by the fact that as late as the 14th century, the Imperial German Party continued to exist in Florence. Who knows whether Lombardy would not still be in our hands today if prince vassals like Heinrich the Lion had not broken their oaths of fealty, counteracted the policy of the Reich, and compelled the emperor suddenly to interrupt his campaigns in the south in order to extinguish the blaze that had broken out in his own house. The policy of the Reich can be successful only if it is characterized by unity of action.
You want to comment on this part here a little bit before we go on and forget about it? No.
No? You have anything?
He's talking about the policy in the East, which I think is really important to, you know, what mm-hmm. he has to say about it. And he even calls it, where is that? The German policy in the East. So, and he says that they never had one before, and he
yes.
kind of has the first one. And he's criticizing, he likes Heinrich the First because he went in that direction, but it was not because he had a real policy, but because that's the only place he saw he could make a kingdom for himself. But
yep.
he's criticizing again Henry the Lion because he was like an independent guy. I guess he was really clever and competent and so on. And he's highly lionized in Germany, you know, in history. They call him Heinrich the Lion. But Hitler's constantly critical of him because he says he didn't stick with the policy of Barbarossa and of the Reich. And he went off and did things on his own, and he thinks that's very dangerous. It just shows how strongly Hitler feels about unity. And somewhere here, I think, he even makes that comment again, which he's known for, that Germany cannot succeed at all unless it's completely unified. All Germans are on the same. And that was such a probably impossible expectation.
Yes.
He thought he could bring it about, or he hoped he did, I guess. I think he hoped he did because he thought that's what was necessary. And in the end, he said, had said a few times that he was just disappointed in that he was wrong, that the Germans could be that unified, that because of all those traitors that ended up screwing everything up. So, you know, going against him and so on. So that's, I just found that really interesting to hear what he had to say here. So then he's going to go on to some more, so.
Yeah. In this respect, the Swabians especially deserve our esteem, for they always realize the meaning of the imperial idea and never cease to prove their loyalty to the Reich. We're certainly wrong to glorify princes like Heinrich the Lion because of their nonconformism. These are men who clearly conducted a policy against the interests of the Reich. That's why I've drawn Rosenberg's attention to the fact that one mustn't let the great German emperors be relegated to the background to the benefit of perjurers, and that it was improper to call a hero like Charlemagne by the name Killer of Saxons. History must be interpreted in terms of the necessities of the time. I just want to say right there that that is such an important statement. Anybody ever wishing to understand the events of history has to have that attitude. Take yourself out of the present. Don't be judgmental of how things were back then. Put yourself back in that time and the prevailing things going on before you... You have to do that to understand why certain moves were made. Anyway, Hitler
That's
said
right.
History must be interpreted in terms of the necessities of the time. It's possible that in 1,000 years, supposing that for one reason or another, the Reich is again obliged to pursue a policy directed against the South, some pedagogue may be found who will claim that Hitler's Eastern policy was certainly well-intentioned, but that it was nevertheless crack-brained, since he should have aimed at the South. Perhaps even some cavalier of this type will go so far as to call me the killer of Austrians on the grounds that on my return from Austria to Germany, I locked up all those who had tried to thwart the enterprise. Without
well, you
compulsion,
know, here it's like, you know, Charlemagne is accused of killing, of murdering those who...
Killer of Saxons,
well, Yeah, killer of Saxons. But then Charlemagne is blamed for, or is he, what the church did in persecuting and killing, really, all those
pagan tribes.
Is that Charlemagne, was Charlemagne right there then during that time? And
yes.
That's my understanding. Okay.
Yes.
But he's still saying that Charlemagne is the great hero who who created an empire. And Hitler is really big on this German empire, this, you know, this German unity, because it was always so broken up into pieces, and how important, of course, it still was, but how important that was. So I think this is pretty controversial, too. I don't know if it means as much as what I think, but, and he says, you know, when he left Austria after the Anschluss and all, that he locked up those who tried to... thwart the new Anschluss, and
right.
So they'd call him that. So he's saying, you know, there's those people who are against what you're trying to do. You have to at least put them in prison, I guess, or you have to stop them. So this is where, I don't know. You know, I just leave it at that. We're always going to talk a little bit about Christianity. So go on.
Right. Then the Fuhrer says, without compulsion, we would never have united all the various German families with these thick-headed, parochially minded fellows, either in Charlemagne's time or today. If the German people is the child of ancient philosophy and Christianity, it is so less by reason of a free choice than by reason of a compulsion exercised upon it by these triumphant forces. In the same way, in imperial times, it was under the empire of compulsion that the German people engineered its fusion beneath a Christianity represented by a universal church in the image of ancient Rome, which also inclined to universality. It is certain that a man like Charlemagne was not inspired merely by a desire for political power, but sought in faithfulness to the ancient idea for an expression of civilization. Now the example of the ancient world proves that civilization can flourish only in states that are solidly organized. What would happen to a factory given over to anarchy in which the employees came to their work only when the fancy took them. Without organization, that is to say, without compulsion, and consequently without sacrifice on the part of individuals, nothing can work properly. Organized life offers the spectacle of a perpetual renunciation by individuals of a part of their liberty. The more exalted a situation a man occupies, the easier this renunciation should appear to him. Since his field of vision is wider, he should be able all the better to admit the necessity of self-compulsion. In a healthy state, this is what distinguishes the elite from the men who remain mingled with the great masses. The man who rises must grow with his task. His understanding must expand simultaneously with his functions. If a street sweeper is unable or unwilling to sacrifice his tobacco or his beer, then I think, very well, my good man, that's precisely why you are a street sweeper and not one of the ruling personalities of the state. It's just as well, by the way, that things are like that, for the nation collectively has just as much need of its street sweepers. I want to stop right there because that part struck me very positively, Carolyn, because it's so National Socialist. It's, you know, it's so right on with the philosophy that drove those men. And I really liked it where that I underlined that sentence where he says, organized life offers the spectacle of a perpetual renunciation by individuals of a part of their liberty. Meaning, you know, sacrifice for the good of the state, you know, and so anyway, to me, that's that struck me pretty positively reading this part.
Well, me too. I thought this was just absolutely awesome and really important, and we could talk about this for a long time. But here I think I found the answer to what I was saying earlier, saying that, and this is so German, you know, and this is why he thinks Germany has to do this job, you know, for Europe, because it requires this things to be organized, and when you organize things, people have to follow the organization, right? And they can't do whatever they want to do, and so that takes away some of their freedom right there. And then when you're, you know, you're having to serve the whole, the organized, unified group, you know, well, then you don't do what you want to do. So he saw the German people as being capable of doing their duty and serving, and that's why they could. He didn't see the Germans as, well, we're going to now take over all this territory and we're going to, you know, put you people to work for us and we're going to rob what you have and, you know, we're going to just live it up. But he didn't see that at all. That never appealed to him. He saw the Germans as actually in service to the whole, and that they were the ones who could do it, and he was trying to even, you know, increase that in the German people with the National Socialist Party and its various, you know, auxiliaries and so on, that they would be able to do that, and you would have this beautiful European organization that would be able to defend itself from all its enemies. And you know, this right here is the heart of what I was saying in the beginning, that I became so convinced now of what he was doing and why it was so good, even though so many people complain about it. It was something about that, it was about the paganism. You know, his talking about Charlemagne reveals that he didn't have sympathy with the pagans, and a lot of pagans want to say that National Socialism is, I don't mean to be against pagans or anything, but that National Socialism is pagan because Himmler was interested in all of that, and Rosenberg too, but, you know, in the sense of, you know, what was really Germanic. But Hitler never was drawn to it, and he really saw the Roman idea and other ideas like that as superior, and so he's not even upset with Charlemagne for what he did, because he held things together and made this great German Holy Roman Empire. And somewhere he's going to say a little more about that, but the Holy Roman was just a name; it didn't have any real meaning because he's not religious in that way. He's not pro-Christian here. He's pro And you could say he's pro-German, strong German state, but he's really pro, I think here, it really shows white people, you know what I mean, Europeans, and what's necessary to be done. Couldn't be more right either.
Right.
So.
Guided by these rules, which are quite simple and quite natural, Charlemagne gathered the Germans into a well-cemented community and created an empire that continued to deserve the name long after his death. The fact was that this empire was made of the best stuff of the ancient Roman Empire, so much so that for centuries the peoples of Europe have regarded it as the successor to the universal empire of the Caesars. The fact that this German empire was named the Holy Roman Empire has nothing whatsoever to do with the church and has no religious significance. Unlike the idea attached to the word Reich, the idea of the Chancellor of the Reich has unfortunately lost its significance in the course of the centuries. On a single occasion, a giant gave it its full glory, and then it came to signify abortions like Wirth, Bruning, etc. At present, in view of the authoritarian form we have given the state, that has no importance. One can even declare that this title is not a suitable designation for the head of the state. Historically, as a matter of fact, it is connected with the mental picture according to which, above the chancellor, there is yet another person who represents the state as its supreme chief. And it little matters whether he is called emperor, president, or by some quite different name.
Hey, Ray, I think,
yes.
You know, when he said on a single occasion, speaking about the Reich, and that the chancellor was not quite the right word for the leader, but he said on one occasion a giant gave it its full glory, and I thought, well, now who's that? But you know, I think it has to be Bismarck. Do you?
Uh-huh.
I mean, because Bismarck was called chancellor, you know, so that has to be it. And then these others are much more modern chancellors, Wirth and Bruning. So,
yeah,
I just thought that was, you know, it's one of those things you have to figure out yourself. So I thought
right.
I'd mention
that. And you know what? You're probably correct there. I thought of Frederick the Great when I read that, but Bismarck.
He wasn't
chancellor.
Was
right, that's right.
He didn't have the title chancellor. So that's why
yeah.
I settled on Bismarck, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good statement. In the National Socialist form of state, the title Führer is the most suitable. It implies, amongst other things, the idea that the head of the state has been chosen by the German people. Although it sometimes produces superfluities and overlappings, when one reads beneath the photograph, for example, at the Führer's side, the Oberführer, so-and-so, that has no importance, at least while I'm still alive. But when I'm no longer there, it will be necessary to alter that and to give the notion of Führer a uniform meaning. In any case, it would be inopportune to change the title of the head of state, since this title is associated with the very form of the state itself. In addition to being a display of family pride in political matters, it was Napoleon's greatest error, and at the same time a proof of bad taste on his part, to have renounced the title of First Consul in order to have himself called Emperor. As a matter of fact, it was under the title of First Consul that the revolution, the one that shook the world, carried him to power above the Directoire, that public house committee, him, the Republican general. By giving up this title and having himself called Emperor, he denied the Jacobins, his former companions in the struggle, and lost their support. At the same stroke, he alienated both at home and abroad countless partisans who saw in him the personification of the moral resurrection that the French Revolution was to bring with it. To understand the effect produced by this willful action, it's enough to imagine the effect it would have on the people of Munich and on the rest of the world, if I had myself carried through the streets of Munich in a gilded coach.
I think that
in any
really
case,
funny.
Napoleon gained nothing by committing this fault, for the old monarchies did not fail to display the scorn they felt for a self-made man. The only thing he ever got from them was the Habsburgertum, a joke on the name of the Habsburg dynasty and the word Burgertum, meaning bourgeoisie, which was foisted upon him and whose arrival irremediably wounded the national pride of the French. In fact, in the eyes of the French, the lovely Josephine, cast off in favor of the Habsburgertum, was the model of the strictly republican French woman. She was esteemed as the woman who, at Napoleon's side, had climbed the rungs leading to the highest post in the state. The stupefaction caused in Europe by that title of emperor is well characterized by the gesture of Beethoven, who tore up a symphony he had just dedicated to Napoleon. He trampled on the fragments, exclaiming, "He's not the extraordinary man I believed. He's only a man." What's tragic in Napoleon's case is that when he adopted the imperial title, formed a court, and instituted a ceremonial, he didn't realize that by making common cause with degenerates, he was merely putting himself on their level. Personally, I should regard it as an example of pure lunacy. If anyone came and offered me, for example, a dukedom, it would be like asking me to recognize bonds of kinship with all the dwarfs who bear the title. By looking after his relatives' interest as he did, Napoleon furthermore displayed incredible weakness on the purely human level. When a man occupies such a position, he should eliminate all his family feeling. Napoleon, on the contrary, placed his brothers and sisters in posts of command and retained them in these posts even after they'd given proofs of their incapability. All that was necessary was to throw out all these patently incompetent relatives. Instead of that, he wore himself out with sending his brothers and sisters regularly every month letters containing reprimands and warnings, urging them to do this and not do that, thinking he could remedy their incompetence by promising them money or by threatening not to give them any more. Such illogical behavior can be explained only by the feeling Corsicans have for their families, a feeling in which they resemble the Scots.
By thus so, Ray, is that the way the Scots are?
Apparently. That's why they've always been kind of known as clannish or the clan.
Yeah,
you know,
I was going to say,
clan.
That's where the clan idea comes from.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh.
Very, very close to their clan. Okay.
Okay. By thus giving expression to his family, feeling, Napoleon introduced a disruptive principle into his life. Nepotism, in fact, is the most formidable protection imaginable. The protection of the ego. But wherever it has appeared in the life of a state, the monarchies are the best proof, it has resulted in weakening and decay. The reason? It puts an end to the principle of effort. In this respect, Frederick the Great showed himself superior to Napoleon. Frederick, who, at the most difficult moments of his life, and when he had to take the hardest decisions, never forgot that things are called upon to endure. In similar cases, Napoleon capitulated. It's therefore obvious that to bring his life's work to a successful conclusion, Frederick the Great could always rely on sturdier collaborators than Napoleon could. When Napoleon set the interests of his family clique above all, Frederick the Great looked around him for men and at need trained them himself. Despite all Napoleon's genius, Frederick the Great was the most outstanding man of the 18th century. When seeking to find a solution for essential problems concerning the conduct of affairs of state, he refrained from all illogicality. It must be recognized that in this field, his father, Frederick Wilhelm, that buffalo of a man, had given him a solid and complete training. Peter the Great, too, clearly saw the necessity for eliminating the family spirit from public life. In a letter to his son, a letter I was rereading recently, he informs him very clearly of his intention to disinherit him and exclude him from the succession to the throne. "It would be too lamentable," he writes, "to set one day at the head of Russia a son who does not prepare himself for state affairs with the utmost energy, who does not harden his will and strengthen himself physically. Setting the best man at the head of the state, that's the most difficult problem in the world to solve. In a republic in which the whole people is called upon to elect the chief of the state, it's possible, with money and publicity, to bring the meagerest of puppets to power. In a republic in which the reins of power are in the hands of a clique made up of a few families, the state takes on the aspect of a trust in which the shareholders have an interest in electing a weakling as president so that they may play an important part themselves. A hereditary monarchy is a biological blunder, for a man of action regularly chooses a wife with essentially feminine qualities, and the son inherits his mother's mildness and passive disposition. In a republic that sets at its head a chief elected for life, there's the risk that he will pursue a policy of personal self-interest. In a republic where the chief of state changes every 5 or 10 years, the stability of the government is never assured, and the execution of long-term plans exceeding the duration of a lifetime is thereby compromised. If one sets at the head of the state an old man who has withdrawn from all worldly considerations, he is only a puppet, and inevitably it's the other men who rule in his name. Thinking over all of that, I've arrived at the following conclusions. 1. The chances of not setting a complete idiot at the head of the state are better under the system of free elections than in the opposite case. The giants, who were the elected German emperors, are the best proof of this. There was not one of them of whom it can be truly said that he was an imbecile. In the hereditary monarchies, on the other hand, there were at least 8 kings out of 10 who, if they'd been ordinary citizens, would not have been capable of successfully running a grocery. 2. In choosing a chief of state, one must call upon a personality who, as far as human beings can judge, guarantees a certain stability in the exercise of power for a longish while. This is a necessary condition, not only so that public affairs can be successfully administered, but in order to make possible the realization of great projects. 3. Care must be taken that the chief of state will not succumb to the influence of the plutocracy and cannot be forced to certain decisions by any pressure of that sort. That's why it's important that he should be supported by a political organization whose strength has its roots in the people and which can have the upper hand over private interests. In the course of history, 2 constitutions have proved themselves. A. The papacy, despite numerous crises, the gravest of which, as it happens, were settled by German emperors, and although it is based on a literally crazy doctrine, but as an organization on the material level, the church is a magnificent edifice. B. The Constitution of Venice, which, thanks to the organization of its government, enabled a little city republic to rule the whole eastern Mediterranean. The Constitution of Venice proved itself effective as long as the Venetian Republic endured, and that is to say for 960 years. The fact that the head of the Republic of Venice was chosen from amongst the families who composed the framework of the state, numbering between 300 and 500, was not a bad thing. Thus, power was allotted to the best man amongst the representatives of those families who were traditionally linked with the state. The difference between this system and that of hereditary monarchy is obvious. In the former, it was impossible for an imbecile or an urchin of 12 to come to power. Only a man who had pretty well proved himself in life had a fair chance of being appointed. Isn't it ridiculous, by the way, to think that a child of 12 or even 18 can rule a state? It goes without saying that if a king is still a minor, power is provisionally gathered in other hands, those of a council of regents. But supposing the members of this council disagree, and the more competent the counselors are, the greater are the risk of disagreement in view of the complexity of the problems to be solved daily, then the absence is felt of the personality capable of taking a sovereign decision. A youth of 18 cannot take a decision that requires deep reflection. That's difficult enough for a man who has reached full maturity. It's enough to imagine where King Michael of Romania would be without the support of a man as remarkable as Field Marshal Antonescu. As it happens, the young man is stupid. Moreover, he's been rotted by his spoilt child's upbringing, his father having entrusted him entirely to women during the most important period of his development. To sense the tragic nature of this abyss, it's enough to compare the development of any man who's ambitious to do so something in life with that of a prince by inheritance. Think of the amount of knowledge that a man of normal rank must acquire, of the desperate work he must do without truce or rest to succeed in having his own way. There's a tendency to believe, on the contrary, that one can prepare budding kings for the task that awaits them by keeping them amused. A third of their time is devoted to the study of foreign languages, so that they may be able to utter trivialities in several tongues. A second third to the sports of society, riding, tennis, etc. The study of the political sciences takes only the last place. Moreover, the education they receive has no firmness. Their tutors are weakness itself. They resist the temptation to distribute the smacks their princely pupils deserve for fear of calling down the disfavor of a future monarch. The result is obvious, and that's how creatures like Michael of Romania and Peter of Yugoslavia were formed. And in this side note, as regards the government of Germany, I've come to the following conclusions. One, the Reich must be a republic, having at its head an elected chief who shall be endowed with an absolute authority. Two, an agency representing the people must, nevertheless, exist by way of corrective. Its role is to support the chief of state, but it must be able to intervene in case of need. Three, the task of choosing the chief shall be entrusted not to the people's assembly, but to a senate. It is, however, important that the powers of the senate shall be limited. Its composition must not be permanent. Moreover, its members shall be appointed with reference to their occupation and not individuals. These senators must, by their training, be steeped in the idea that power may in no case be delegated to a weakling, and that the elected Führer must always be the best man. Four, the selection of the chief must not take place in public, but in camera. On the occasion of the election of a pope, the people does not know what is happening behind the scenes. A case is reported in which the cardinals exchanged blows. Since then, the cardinals have been deprived of all contact with the outside world for the duration of the conclave. This is a principle that is also to be observed for the election of the Führer. All conversations between, or with, the electors will be forbidden throughout operations. Five, the party, the army, and the body of officials must take an oath of allegiance to the new chief within the 3 hours following the election. Six, the most rigorous separation between the legislative and executive organs of the state must be the supreme law for the new chief. Just as in the party, the SA and the SS are merely the sword to which is entrusted the carrying out of the decisions taken by competent organs, in the same way, the executive agents of the state are not to concern themselves with politics. They must confine themselves exclusively to ensuring the application of laws issued by the legislative power, making appeal to the sword in case of need. Although a state founded on such principles can lay no claims to eternity, it might last for 8 to 9 centuries. The 1,000-year-old organization of the church is a proof of this, and yet this entire organization is founded on nonsense. What I have said should be a fortiori, be true of an organization founded on reason. Wow.
Well, I guess. That's a lot for people to take in.
It is. But it's so fabulous because when I read things like his remark on a republic, of course, I'm thinking of the American Republic as it was originally set up. And so much of that is exactly right. And it was the way this country was designed to by the founders to be an efficient organization representing the people and looking out for the good of the nation, and which was in short order corrupted and ruined. But the things that he describes here in a republic in which the whole people is called upon to elect the chief of state, it's possible with money and publicity to bring the meagerest of puppets to power.
Yeah,
of
right.
course, that's
and
exactly
that's
what
we have, too.
Today. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you know, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. That's all right.
I was just going to say, before we close, I want to get something in here. And that
yeah.
is where he says, hereditary monarchy is a blunder because a man of action or a strong man chooses a wife with essentially feminine qualities, and that's him. That's what he likes. But he says the son will inherit his mother's mildness and passive disposition. And I thought, what an admission that is. If he thinks that if a man marries a very feminine woman, that the sons are going to be too mild and passive, then that's not a good prescription for marrying that kind of a woman if you need strong sons. So obviously, of course, there are always a lot of the different kind of women. And so I suppose a strong woman is the best, or maybe a more outspoken woman or something, or not outspoken, but, you know, takes charge
yeah.
or something, is maybe better for, makes better men, you think? I don't know. You know, I have to take that from what he says there.
Yeah, and that is fascinating, you know, because I disagree with that myself, because I think a very strong son can come from such a feminine woman and all, but I did find it was a very interesting statement, and I'm glad that you went back to it.
Well, I wish we had time to say more about this, and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit next week. Who knows?
Okay.
But you read it so well, and it was very clear to everyone. So I'm going to just sign out real quick, Ray, for everybody. This has been Hitler's Table Talk, and we'll see you again next week.
Yes, thank you.